This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first thing that interested me about Susan Miller's new family memoir was her portrait of her father, a man who loved jazz and hung out with jazz musicians. But what begins as a portrait of a hipster father turns into an examination of family secrets and how they shape family life. Her new book, Never Let Me Down, has been excerpted in Harper's and the literary magazine Granta. We invited Susan Miller to talk about the book and read an excerpt. Here's the opening of Never Let Me Down.
One night, at an hour that was normally my bedtime, I got all dressed up, and my mother and father and I drove into New York, down to the Half Note, the jazz club on Hudson Street. I was 13, maybe 14, just beginning teenagehood, and had never gone anywhere that was nightlife. I had heard jazz all my life, on records or on the radio, my father beating out time on the kitchen table, the steering wheel, letting out a breathy, yeah, when the music soared and flew. When they were cooking, when they really swung, it transported him. He was gone, inside the music. I couldn't go on this trip with him, but I could understand it. It seemed to me that anyone could, hearing that music. Bird, Diz, Prez, Sweets, Lester, Al, Zoot, it was my father's music, though he himself never played a note. I knew the players, for about the only friends my parents had were musicians and their wives. When I was a little kid, I'd lie in bed listening to them talk their hip talk in the next room. I knew I was the only kid in Washington Heights to be overhearing words like man and cat and groove and jokes that were this irreverent and black. I knew they were cool, and I loved it. At the Half Note that night, the three of us walked through the door, and the owner appeared, all excited to see my father. And in the middle of this smoky nightlife room, he kissed my hand. This was real life, the center of something. We sat down. In front of us on a little stage were Jimmy Rushing, a powerful singer, and two sax players, Al Cohn and Zoot Sims, whom I'd known all my life. And there was a whole room full of people slapping the tables, beating out time, breathing yeah at the great moments, shaking their heads, sometimes snapping their fingers, now and then bursting out with play it, man, or sing it. When the break came, Zoot sat down with us and ate a plate of lasagna or something and didn't say much except for these dry asides that were so funny I couldn't bear it, too funny to laugh at. And there was my dad. These men were his friends, his buddies. They liked the things about my father that I could like, how funny he was, uncorny, how unsentimental, unafraid to be different from anyone else in the world, how he was unafraid to be on the edge. As a child, I didn't know that my father and many of the musicians who sat with their wives in our living room, eating nuts and raisins out of cut glass candy dishes, were junkies.
This is Susan Miller, reading from her new memoir, Never Let Me Down. Susan, how did you find out that your father was a junkie?
Well, I found out because when I was 21 years old, a senior in college, my dad and I were out to dinner together, and he was talking about, in the course of the conversation, some friends of his who had been addicts. And I, at that point in my life, knew that a number of his friends had been addicts, but I had never even begun to think that he had been one. And he was talking about how there aren't many old addicts in the world. And the reason for that, he said, is that they either overdose and die, or they get too old to kind of make the scene that's involved in getting the drugs. And then he said, just in the next breath, and that's what happened to me. And then he continued to talk about something else. And I just sat there and didn't really take it in, sort of put it in the back of my mind, I guess. And as soon as I was back in the place I was living that evening, it just became quite clear to me that this was the truth, although a part of me was questioning, had I misheard him? Sort of deep inside, I knew, no, this really was what had happened.
I bet that explained a lot of family mysteries and a lot of mysterious behavior within the family.
Well, it did, although at first it was so overwhelming that I had no information. I had to talk to my mother the next day and try to find out, first of all, was it really true, and to get some sort of a story, because from what he said, I had no idea what was involved, how long, what, you know, anything. And she was able to give me enough information for me to begin a long process of kind of reconstruction of our history.
How did your father, I want to backtrack a little bit, how did your father end up being such good friends with, you know, now famous jazz musicians like Zoot Sims and Al Cohn, mm-hmm. Stan Getz, you mentioned as one of his friends.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, in a way, I don't know the answer, of course, but and a sort of interpersonal level. But he was a really very funny man in a very kind of caustic way, which a lot of the musicians were. They were very funny guys, and a lot of those showbiz people. But in, you know, in the jazz musicians especially, is kind of hard-bitten, very funny humor, which my father had. He was very intelligent. And he totally loved the music. And he was just one of these people who I think people enjoyed being with. So he managed to become real friends with people. I don't think he was just sort of a groupie or a hanger-on. He was really part of the sort of in-ish or in-group, especially with these white musicians who were his real friends. Really good personal friends. And then I think that because so many of them were junkies, that was also a further bond, shall we say, among them all.
Your father loved jazz, had many jazz musician friends, but he made his living dressing store windows of ladies' shops.
Right.
And I'm wondering what if you had any sense of what it was like for him to, you know, have all these friends who are living the jazz life while he's dressing windows for, you know, ladies' dress shops.
Well, I don't think it was really frustrating for him because it's, you know, it's kind of hard. My father was an extremely complicated guy. And, I mean, I think everyone is complicated, but I do find it hard to categorize him. And I think he did not expect himself to achieve anything, you know, out of a kind of self-image problem. And so he enjoyed his friends, but he didn't sit there and say, I wish I were up there playing drums. And I think I would have known if he felt that way, because he certainly talked about lots of things very openly. He kind of hated himself deep down in a lot of ways, and I think that he didn't feel like he wasn't living up to his potential or that sort of thing.
Until your father had confessed to you that he had been a heroin addict, the family in a way revolved around the secret of his addiction, the secret which your mother knew but was kept from you and your brother. What kind of mysterious behavior did the heroin explain when you found out about it?
Well, it explained some very basic things, like where was my father? You know, like when I was a kid, he wasn't home much, and my mother was always saying he was working, but he would be, you know, working at night, and he didn't work at night. And where was he? And also, another problem for me had been as a kid, why were we so poor if he was working so much? I mean, we were like, you know, on the edge, and this guy was out there working. And so that was one thing that immediately I began to understand. The other thing was just this pervasive depression and anger that was in the house all the time that I think, you know, exists in families anyway, but the proportion of it didn't seem to fit into what was going on in the house. It was too much, and it certainly explained that part of it. And also my father being kind of out of it quite a bit when I was a kid, not really seeming tuned in.
A lot of people really wish that they had a hipster parent, an unconventional parent. Your father was a hipster. He was very unconventional. What were some of the kind of pain and pleasure of having a hipster father?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Well, the pleasure was that I always admired his, well, he was very intelligent, and I always admired his ability he didn't finish high school, but he read all the time, and he really thought for himself about a lot of things. So even though that's sort of not a hipster quality, his opinions about things were very sort of individualized, and I admired that tremendously. And he also made fun of everything in the world. I mean, nothing was sacred to him. And I loved that. You know, there was nobody that I had to respect, that sort of thing. And that was the good part of it. The bad part of it was that, you know, we never were part of any community we lived in. My parents had really little or nothing to do with these very kind of ordinary communities that we lived in. I mean, we weren't living in the Greenwich Village or anything. We were really out there with everyone else, and there was no sense of us being knitted into any of the communities we lived in or anyone ever understanding anything that was going on in my house, my friends. I mean, we were just odd. And because we were unhappy, it wasn't like, oh, it's great to be odd, an odd family. But I did think it was great to be able to look at the world without all these kind of phony expectations and demands that other kids seem to have.
You were pleased that your father, you know, didn't just kind of toe the line when it came to, like, you know, middle class mm-hmm. values. On the other hand, there are things that he did that were socially unacceptable and that really troubled you. Like you say, he was a man of socially unacceptable habits. Mm-hmm. He was fat, he picked his teeth, he burped, he farted, he blew his nose into the mm-hmm. sink in the morning. Mm-hmm. Fat, you know?
Like, yeah, right. Oh, he was like disgusting.
Who wants right. this in public? Yeah. So what did you think, that you were somebody who could, you know, burp and pass air in public, blow his nose into the sink, and like not think there was anything wrong with that?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a drag. You know, I was pretty interested in, from the time I was young, I was interested in that world out there and what was real behavior and what wasn't. And he was not interested in that. And I wanted to figure out how to act and get along in any situation. I didn't have his, you know, what you could call self-confidence, which in another way it's being oblivious to other people. I didn't have that. And I found him, you know, physically repulsive a lot of the time. I mean, not just out of a sort of, you know, prissiness, but, I mean, he was a disgusting guy in a lot of ways. His habits were disgusting. He would violate your personal space all the time, you know, come really close to you and poke you in the chest if he was talking to you, and you couldn't get away. Like, I'd back away from him, and he'd follow me until I'd be against the wall, you know. He was an overwhelming kind of person. And, yeah, so it was wasn't like pleasant being in the room with him. In fact, I often hated it.
My guest is Susan Miller. Her new family memoir is called Never Let Me Down. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Susan Miller, author of the new family memoir, Never Let Me Down. Mm-hmm. Now, you say that your father insisted that his addiction had no serious consequences for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it did. I mean, your family was poor. Your father wasn't home very much. Your mother was chronically depressed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were real serious consequences for the family. How did he manage to miss that, do you think?
Well, he was self-involved. I don't really think that explains what the sort of psychological mechanism of his mind, but I think he just did not really know. He had a very good imagination, but he didn't know how to get into the mind of other or the feelings of other people. It was like a lack of empathy. You know, he wasn't like a sadistic monster or something, but he was missing. Well, I think, you know, he was like a character disorder person versus a neurotic person. I mean, he just didn't get it, that what he did affected other people, and he did things out of his own motivation for his own comfort. In other words, he didn't leave our family and go off and live in a hotel room and shoot up all the time, because for him there was something important about staying with us. But I wouldn't say he stayed with us for our sake. He stayed with us for his sake.
He died of liver cancer that was related to the heroin habit he used to have. When he was dying, there was a social worker who was working with him. And you say that she asked him, the social worker asked him, what he'd miss most when he died. And he said, why don't you say what he said?
Well, he said he'd miss his wife and kids, but what he'd really miss was the music. And then he said, the music's the only thing that's never let me down. And I really, at that point in our relationship, I just found that to be such a perfect summation, in a way, of who he was, because I do think that was true, that the music was really important to him and in a way saved him. I mean, anything you love like that can save you. But here he was saying this in front of my mother, who had, you know, never let him down, in a sense, had stayed with him all these years. And it was like it didn't connect to him that this could hurt her, that he could say this. So it wasn't so much what he was feeling, that it wasn't an evil thing to feel, but it was a very unfeeling thing to say it to her, in front of her.
In a way, it sounds like your father really wasn't cut out to be a family man, although he enjoyed some aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you reach a certain age and you understand that not everybody's cut out to have a family, but I'm sure you always regret it when one of those people not cut out for it happens to be your father.
Yeah, right.
So do you feel that on the one hand you like understand and understand what it was like for him, and on the other hand really resent it?
I don't really totally feel like I'll ever understand it. I don't feel like I have a real deep understanding and forgiveness and all those things. It's more that I just at this point accept or try my best to know who he was, and I don't any longer feel threatened by his lack of perception, you know, or his lack of my own sense that he didn't see me as a separate person from him. That doesn't, you know, he's dead, and writing the book really helped with that. So I don't really understand him, but I sort of know him. In a way, and that's the best I can do with that.
During your formative years, when your father was addicted and often, you know, lost in another world, and your mother was often very depressed and, mm-hmm. and barely able to cope, your brother, who was a year and a half older than you, used to beat you up pretty badly on a regular
yeah.
basis, and it was part of his fantasy life was a series of, you know, like imaginary skits and sketches which required, you know, really hurting you.
Yeah, right. And
eventually he sexually abused you, too. And mm-hmm. your parents, both of them really managed to remain oblivious to this in spite of the fact that you were pretty bruised a good deal of the time. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think about why you didn't just tell them about it and ask them to intervene?
Well, yeah, I did think about it. I was absolutely convinced that they knew. I mean, it was impossible in my mind that they couldn't know, because it was the most blatant thing in my life, in my house. I mean, it was just this constant thing. So for them to not know was like, how could you not know that, you know, the sky is blue? It was that basic to me that they had to know this. And it was a total shock to me to find out that they didn't. So my sort of, you know, construction of this as a kid was, well, of course they knew, and that their decision was that my brother had a lot of problems, and he wasn't doing well in school, he didn't have friends, I was doing well in school, I had friends, he was very, very angry, I wasn't angry, sort of I was well and he was sick, and if he needed to hit me, that I had to allow him to do that because it might make him feel better. And I had sort of like extra, you know, good stuff inside me because I was healthy. And so I could sort of put, you know, I could take it. And, you know, this was completely clear to me. This was what was going on with everyone. That was my grasp of it. And in fact, you know, I think it was true. My mother even now says, well, I must have known. But she, you know, it was a sort of your classic case of incredible denial. My father was out of it. My mother was afraid of my brother, who could be a bit scary, and she is pretty sort of a timid person in a lot of ways. I think she chose not to see what was going on because she couldn't do anything about it. She couldn't face her own inability to act. So the easiest thing was to kind of say, well, you know, he hits her some, you know, brothers and sisters fight. And that absolved her of a need to take some action, which she was not capable of taking.
Susan Miller's new memoir is called Never Let Me Down. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Susan Miller. Her new book, Never Let Me Down, is a memoir about family secrets. Her father was a window dresser who loved jazz and hung out with jazz musicians. It wasn't until she was 21 that she learned her father also was addicted to heroin. While her father was lost in his world and her mother was in denial, Susan's brother beat her up pretty regularly and sexually abused her. It amazed her that her father believed that his addiction had no consequences for the family. You know, one of the questions you ask in your book, which is, I think, a question everybody asks, whether they phrase it as succinctly or not, can you blame damaged people for their misdeeds?
Yeah.
So, I mean, how much, you've obviously thought about that question a lot.
Yeah.
What's your answer to it?
Well, I don't think there is a really good answer, although, interestingly enough, probably about 6 months ago, I happened to go to a conference on, I think the subject was domestic violence in Jewish women or in Jewish homes or something, which isn't the kind of thing I normally go to, but I went with my mother. And I wound up speaking to a rabbi, a woman rabbi, at the end of the conference, and she told me that there's some teaching by Maimonides, I guess, about this whole issue of blame. If someone does you harm, are you required to forgive them? And she said that the theory or the idea of this is, no, you're not. If someone wrongs you, you're not required to forgive them unless they apologize to you. And even that is not enough. You still don't have to forgive them. The only time when you should forgive them is when they, after they apologize, they then have to act differently towards you. And then you can forgive them. And that was very helpful for me to hear because there, all of our lives, we're kind of bombarded with this idea that, you know, you must forgive everything. And I don't think that's a very helpful idea. I think people become oppressed by that into feeling, as I often did, that you're doing something wrong, even if you haven't done something wrong, just because you're mad at someone for doing something wrong to you. But I don't think that there's a clear answer to how much people are to blame for their own limitations. How much they can get out of that.
Did you ever get the apology and the change of behavior?
No, and that's why that question, her answer to that question was so important to me, because my problem with my father in the later years of my life was that he could not apologize in any way for what had happened, and he could not say, "What I did hurt you." All he could say is, this had nothing to do with you. It was my life. And I had a really good time at that point in my life. And
He had a good time at that point in his life.
Yes, yeah. Yes, he did. You know, this was a great time in his life. And why? And what he wanted to do was tell me what fun he had had.
Back when he was addicted.
Right, and tell me all these interesting things that had happened to him, which I'm sure were really interesting. But I couldn't listen to those without sort of, you know, obliterating my own self. So I couldn't hear that, and he couldn't understand that. So we were at a real impasse around this.
How did you first approach talking to your mother about all the secrets in your family? Because your mother was kind of in denial about it and very depressed during much of your childhood.
Well, after my father mentioned this to me, about his addiction when we were out to dinner, I asked my mother the next day, I think Dad just told me last night that he used to be a heroin addict. And my mother broke down and started crying and said, oh, he finally told you. She had, for reasons that are not really clear to me, had agreed or decided that he should be the one to tell me this, although I was 21 years old, and she certainly could have decided to tell me herself, but she didn't. So, you know, sometimes I wonder if he never told me, would she have ever told me? But then she started to talk. Once it was like, now it's permissible to speak. And she began to tell me what had happened, which was very sad to listen to because she had a very sad story to tell of her own.
You know, your mother has emerged from all of this as, you know, a speaker at feminist conferences, yeah, and someone who helps, I think, lead self-help groups and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like if she were in denial, she isn't any longer.
Well, she's been in therapy in the last few years. Actually, when I wrote the part of this that was published in Granta, I gave it to her to read before it was published, and it had an amazing effect on her. She, like my father, is a very interesting person, and she's, in a way, she's a very timid person, but in another way, she's also very unafraid, and it made her face, I didn't know it was going to do this, but it wound up causing her to face all these things that she had denied. And she went off into therapy, which she's still in, and has made remarkable strides in trying to deal with the past, which she was always somebody who was good at pushing it aside. And she's kind of stopped doing it. It's really wonderful. And she's 78. So,
what does it say to you that there are so many people who we're finding out now because they're writing about it and they're talking about it? So many people who are incest victims, or who someone in their family beat them or psychologically mm-hmm. abused them in some way. I mean, these stories are just so alarmingly common now.
I know. I know. It's amazing, isn't it? Especially what's really amazing is how few of these stories were told until just recently. I mean, mm-hmm. it is like the floodgates opened. When I first started writing this, there were almost no memoirs. I mean, this is all, I searched for books that talked about really bad things, memoirs, not novels, that talked about all these things that you're saying. And there really weren't any. There were only a couple of books. And I wound up going to Holocaust memoirs to try to find people writing about these things about guilt and blame and physical pain. And now there are so many of them. And I'm not really sure what's happened, but I think feminism has a lot to do with it. And you know, everybody's kind of telling this stuff, and I don't know if we can look at that and say that it's rampant, or my guess is that it was just so forbidden to be discussed that there's this tremendous need to kind of get it out there now that we can talk about it. And you know that people no longer, I mean, this kind of parental respect that I think was so powerful through the ages has eroded, and people are able to tell these stories and not suffer for them the way they would have had to suffer for them like 100 years ago.
And that strikes you as a good thing?
Yeah, I guess it does strike me as a good thing because I feel like kids have suffered a lot. And not that this is kind of thing is going to stop kids from suffering, but I think they'll realize that they're not alone.
Has it helped you at all to know that you're not alone, because there have been so many people confessing to abuse within the family, you know, confessing about how they were abused when they were children? Is that of any use to you in getting over the psychological after effects of what happened in your family?
I think it is partly because I think that if it hadn't changed, I mean, even if I'd written this exact book, but during the days of silence, so to speak, I think I would have, I don't know if I ever would have gotten it published, but also I would have felt much more that I was telling things that people were finding incredibly shocking, you know, to speak against one's family. And there's at least a freedom to do that. Whether it's, you know, in a societal sense, good or bad, I can't really say.
My guest is Susan Miller. Her new family memoir is called Never Let Me Down. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Susan Miller, author of the new family memoir, Never Let Me Down. Your book opens with a quote from William Carlos Williams. The quote is, memory is a kind of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. What's the significance of that quote for you?
Well, it's from this poem where he says that the descent beckoned is the ascent beckoned. Memory is a kind of accomplishment. And I think in that poem he's talking about getting older and just having lived is a kind of accomplishment. But I think for me that quote really speaks to me on the level of making a story for my life, which I didn't have when I was so confused as a kid about what was going on. And it was tremendously important for me always to try to understand what was happening, and I couldn't. Right. And when I finally found out about my father's addiction, I began to be able to make what I think of as a story of my life that made some sense. And that, to me, is making memories that hang together, and that is an accomplishment. It's kind of, I realize now it's sort of the project I was working on from the time I was a little kid, with success and failure.
Explain to me more of this, the value for you of having, you know, what you describe as a coherent story of your life.
What happened as a kid, like, things would just happen. And I suppose it was partly me being somebody who wanted to understand what was going on between people. But I kept always coming up against these things that would just seem like, wait, you know, how can this fit with that? You know, like, why are we moving now? You know, so-and-so said such-and-such, and that doesn't seem to fit into that. So I was always coming up against these blocks of, like, dead ends. And I think through reading books, I also learned that there were ways that things can make sense, that people's reactions to each other can follow a kind of, not logic, but it's like an internal logic that works. And what was going on in my house never made any sense. So to me, making a story meant making a self that I couldn't feel I was a person in some way without being able to reconstruct the story of myself and the people in my family in a way where that sense became clear to me.
You have, what, two children now?
Yes, uh-huh.
Did feeling like you were, a little neglected when you were young, that you had a father who was lost in music land and addicted to heroin, and a mother who was depressed, and a brother who beat you up, did that make you feel like, maybe I won't start a family?
Yeah.
Maybe families aren't the best thing.
Right. Well, as a kid, I had this, you know, total. I really decided I would never have children. I don't even know how old I was when I thought that. I mean, I was pretty little, like 6 or 7. I said, you know, this is so, being a kid is so hard and so horrible. And people are always saying how they love children. Well, you know, what kind of a joke is that? People, if they loved children, they wouldn't have them. This, being a kid, is a nightmare. And, you know, of course, I didn't realize that not all kids felt that way. I assumed everybody was walking around feeling this, and they just didn't talk about it. then I figured out later that maybe that wasn't true. And as I got older and older, I began to realize that. But it was a big decision for me to have a family. I didn't think I'd be capable of it. I was afraid to do it. I didn't want to make the same mistakes. And the way that I was able to do it was partly through my relationship with my husband, who's somebody who I really love a lot and think is really great. I could tell he would be a great parent. And also, as I got more confident in myself, I realized that maybe I could do it too. So I took the chance and did it. And it's worked out quite well.
Do you want your children to read your memoir?
No, they're not allowed to. My son is almost 12, my daughter's almost 15, and they both agreed not to read it. They know. What I've done is I've told them a lot of the things in it, so it's not like a big mystery, but that they can just read it when they're older. There are certainly things in it I'd rather they didn't read now.
I think they'll try to sneak a copy, read it in the bookstore, read the reviews. I mean, you really can't prevent them from reading it.
Well, I can't, although my daughter is less curious than my son, and she's the older one. And my son, who's incredibly curious, has heard me read part of it, and he's very sensitive. I think he doesn't want to sort of find out sad things about me right now. So mm-hmm. He even said, "Mom, I don't really want to read this now." You know, now maybe they will, but I actually have a feeling that they'll put it off for a while.
Susan Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Susan Miller's new memoir is called Never Let Me Down.